Korea was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. The U.S. Justice Department has filed a brief with the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco on behalf of reinstating President Donald Trump's temporary ban on travel from seven countries. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals plans to start hearing oral arguments from both sides Tuesday. The Justice Department's brief contends the ban is a lawful exercise of the president's authority. It calls a federal judge's order suspending the ban vastly overbroad. Nearly 100 companies, two states, and a group of Democrats are filing friend-of-the-court arguments against the ban. A delegation of experts is meeting in Kazakhstan to discuss the ceasefire agreement in Syria. Representatives from Russia, Turkey, Iran, and the United Nations held the first meeting of the Joint Operational Group. They are discussing various issues, including how to monitor the ceasefire agreement and prevent violations, as well as how to ensure the safe delivery of humanitarian aid in Syria. French presidential candidate François Fillon says he will continue his campaign despite media reports that he paid his wife an unjustified salary for 15 years as he was a member of parliament. Claiming his wife was paid fairly for the work she did, Fillon only apologized for the error of judgment in employing his family, but said his wife's salary was perfectly justified for a woman with a training in law. Fillon's popularity has declined significantly since the issue emerged. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has beheaded four civilians. It accused them of spying for the Somali federal government and the Jubaland State Administration. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump promised to give the military his full support in a speech to troops at the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM. CENTCOM is located at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida. In a brief speech following lunch with enlisted personnel, Mr. Trump spoke out against the Islamic State group, which he said is on a campaign of genocide across the globe.
We're up against an enemy that celebrates death and totally worships destruction. You've seen that. ISIS is on a campaign of genocide, committing atrocities across the world. Radical Islamic terrorists are determined to strike our homeland.
Mr. Trump expressed strong support for NATO, saying he only asks that all of the NATO members make what he called their full and proper financial contribution. The Israeli parliament Monday passed a measure that would legalize thousands of Jewish settlements in the West Bank built unlawfully on private land owned by Palestinians. That vote was 60 to 52. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Monday asked British Prime Minister Theresa May to join the United States in imposing new sanctions on Iran because of its recent missile test.
And it offers provocation after provocation. That's why I welcome President Trump's insistence on new sanctions against Iran. I think other nations should follow suit, certainly responsible nations.
The two leaders met at 10 Downing Street in what British officials had hoped would be a session focusing on boosting economic relations. Israeli forces struck Hamas targets in the Gaza Strip Monday following a Palestinian rocket attack on a border area. Palestinian medical officials report three people wounded in the Israeli strikes. Five countries, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger, have decided to set up a new counterterrorism force in the Sahel region. Meeting in Mali's capital, officials from the country said they are alarmed by a mounting jihadist threat in the area. On Sunday, Turkish security forces launched a big crackdown on the Islamic State group. Dorian Jones reports.
Since early Sunday, police have been breaking down the doors of suspected Islamic State members. More than 30 people were detained in Istanbul, many in the area where a gunman responsible for the New Year's Eve nightclub attack was captured by police last month. That attack spurred an unprecedented crackdown on the designated terrorist group. Dozens were arrested in the city of Izmir, and according to local news reports, an imminent attack was foiled. Analysts say this latest crackdown is on an unprecedented level nationwide, with arrests in 29 provinces. Dorian Jones, Istanbul.
Taking a look at markets on Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes were down at the close of trade on Monday. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The South Sudan president ordered the execution of bad elements within the army.
The president was actually making a comparison between the time during the liberation struggle and the current situation. He was saying during the time of liberation, no SLA soldier has ever tried to rape any woman. Because if you rape a woman, you will be executed.
Atain Wek Atain is a spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. President Kiir visits Ye Town, scene of recent fighting in South Sudan. We'll take you inside the secret world of Nigeria's Boko Haram terrorist organization. And the United Nations female genital mutilation must end.
In some communities, like in Kenya, and I think also in Edo, which is in southwestern part of Nigeria, a girl that's not caught is not marriageable. And that is when you find an adult willingly submitting herself to be caught.
Adebisi Adebayo is a program advisor to the UN Inter-Africa Committee on Traditional Practices. And Malawi farmers apply new methods to increase harvest. Those stories, plus our Black History Month facts and contest, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir has been clarifying whether the president ordered the execution of soldiers who commit human rights abuses and atrocities. President Kiir reportedly gave the orders on Monday during a visit to Ye Town in central Equatorial State, the scene of fighting in December 2013. Mr. Kiir called for getting rid of bad elements in the army. The African Union Special Envoy on Women, Peace and Security, Benita Diop, over the weekend called for stronger action against gender-based violence on women in South Sudan. Presidential spokesman Atain Wek Atain says Mr. Kiir did not order extrajudicial killings because independent South Sudan respects human rights. He says the president was simply making a comparison between South Sudan today and South Sudan during the liberation struggle when soldiers who committed rape were executed.
The president was actually making a comparison between the time during the liberation struggle and the current situation as South Sudan became independent. He was saying during the time of liberation, there used to have no rape. No SLA soldier has ever tried to rape any woman. Because if you rape a woman, you will be executed during the SLA time. Now we have what is called human rights. So we cannot execute anybody. But if we had any power of executing the bad element within the army, we would have. So the president was making a suggestion. He did not order the killing of soldier extrajudicially. So the president's speech might have been taken out of context.
So is there a widespread criminal element within the South Sudanese army? And what sort of crimes are these people committing?
Well, the complaint of the community was about rape, that some soldiers comes out in a broad daylight and commit the crime of rape against them. So the president was responding to the community in Yei when he was addressing them. It is not much, but of course, like any other army in the world, there are few reckless individuals who might take law into their own hands. But the government of South Sudan does not have the policy of allowing rape in that widespread manner.
This is coming at a time that the African Union envoy called on your government to take stronger action against gender-based violence in South Sudan. Is President Salva Kiir responding to this call?
Yeah, a number of pressure, whether from outside or from the community, who says that some soldiers take law into their own hands. And the president made a remark in response to these allegations.
What about this report that the president has sacked the administrator of Abia? What's happening in Abia?
No, there is nothing in Abia. There is nothing that has happened. The Abia administration is a joint administration between Sudan and South Sudan. There has never been any reshuffle in Abia administrative area. So this is just fabricated stories, and the Abia administration has not come under reshuffles by the president.
We know that Abia is still a disputed area. Is President Salva Kiir trying to solidify his grip by putting his own people in place there?
No, the president is not doing that. The president believes in amicable solution to Abia problems, It is worth mentioning that the BIA protocols remain unimplemented. It has not been implemented by Khartoum, in which the people of BIA would have been asked to go for a referendum to decide between joining Sudan and South Sudan. So it is Khartoum that has actually stood on the way of a BIA becoming either independent from Sudan or part of South Sudan. But President Salva Kiir is not trying to install these people actually in a way that does not correspond to a BIA protocol.
So the appointment, is this the Ngog Dinka appointment, or who does the president appoint? Does he have any meaning?
But is a BIA being inhabited by people other than the Dinka Ngog? It is a land of Dinka Ngog that found itself transferred to Sudan in 1905. Administratively, and it should come back anytime. The people of Abia opt for coming back to South Sudan. It shouldn't be a big problem. So Abia is a Dinka Ngog land, and it has never been historically part of any other tribe. It is a Dinka that inhabits land. 100% is Dinka land.
Atain Wekatain is a spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. South Sudan President Salva Kiir Monday visited Ye Town to try to assure residents there that the security situation is improving despite repeated deadly attacks in the area. Humanitarian organizations say thousands of people continue to flee parts of Ye River State because of clashes between government forces and members of an armed group. Nabio Biajo has more from Juba.
Ye River State Governor David Lokonga Moses welcomed President Kiir and his high-level delegation to Ye Town.
The president has come here, I think, has delivered a very strong message to people to remain calm and people to make sure that he is really determined to implement the peace agreement.
Governor Lokonga insists his state is secure despite reports of rampant insecurity.
There were no major clashes that have been reported between the government and the SPLA and the town, you can witness the thousand people who are here, and the security situation is calm. Kajikeji also, there was some negative propaganda that they're making people actually to cross to Uganda.
Lokonga urged the tens of thousands who have fled Ye, Morobo, Lanya, and Kajukeji over the past weeks to return home, assuring them that the security situation is stable.
I want to urge the people, you know, not to keep in the neighboring countries preventing the children to go to school.
Lokonga describes recent attacks that have occurred in Kajukeji and other Ye River State counties as isolated incidents, but insists the situation is now under control.
This is some other things like isolated cases in the areas where the armed group always go and mix up with the civilians and they started provoking the government. You know, those people would really adhere to the national call.
Late last year, President Kiir called for an inclusive national dialogue to restore peace to the country. Elias Taban, president of South Sudan Evangelical Alliance in Ye, says church leaders like him and some 50,000 people in Ye town are calling for peace so that those who have fled to neighboring Uganda can return home.
UNHCR and UN OCHA and other humanitarian organizations have registered 50,000 people, and those 50,000 are still here in Ye town. We are praying for peace. We are the church. We want peace, and we want them to come back.
Last month, First Vice President Taban Dengai visited Ye River State to call on all warring parties to lay down their weapons. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biajo in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 7th. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. More than 18,000 people have died in Nigeria's seven-year conflict with Boko Haram, the terror group known for abducting hundreds of Chibok schoolgirls. A Boko Haram trademark has been its secrecy. Now, VOA has obtained a trove of secret videos made by Boko Haram that show firsthand the atrocities committed against defenseless Nigerians at the height of Boko Haram's control of northeast Nigeria, including executions, beatings, and rule by fear.
Kumshi, Borno State, Nigeria. In the dusty square of this small village, morning awakens. One of the world's deadliest terror groups, prepares a lesson in fear and death. This video has never been seen in public. It shows villagers rounded up and forced to witness beatings and executions by armed members of Boko Haram, all in the name of its distorted version of Islam. It comes from 18 hours of secret videos created by Boko Haram and obtained by VOA that document the group's brutal insurgency. Over 7 years, more than 18,000 people have died in Boko Haram violence in Nigeria and its neighbors, many in tribunals like this one. The tribunal is a tool, a ritual of control everyone is forced to watch. A judge leans down, asking three men if they accept Boko Haram's finding of guilt for drug dealing and a penalty of death. The first person, Gambo Abba, argues he didn't do it. The crowd erupts. God is great. Everybody must chant or risk being labeled a traitor for sympathizing with the condemned. All the men deny guilt. For that, their hands will be tied when they are executed. Others charged with using drugs will be killed too if it happens again, the judge says. For now, they will be beaten. A first prisoner is called by name. 10 lashes with a leather swish. God is great with every lash. An old man is called. He is barefoot, his clothing torn. Even a boy is called. A Kumshe man from the crowd is conscripted to beat him. When it is over, he bows towards the Boko Haram banner. The beatings continue more than 30 minutes. Then the men move aside until only the condemned remain. The Boko Haram emir binds the hands of Gambo Abba, lying on the ground. He points his index fingers at the sky and prays, a final gesture that many Muslims believe will open the gates to heaven. From behind, a man with an AK-47 approaches, points the gun at his heart. The next prisoner walks calmly to take his place. He lays next to the dead man and looks at him. The videographer can be heard shouting, "God is great," as the final prisoner lays on the ground. A third executioner approaches, firing 2 shots. Behind the bodies, Boko Haram members drop to their knees and kiss the ground. There is no room for doubt or mercy in Boko Haram's book of justice. "We have delivered God's judgment," one of the executioners tells the crowd. He goes on, "All of these people here are those who spread mischief on earth, not only earth, but in an Islamic state." Timestamps on the video suggest the killings and beatings took place in late 2014, a period when Boko Haram controlled Kumshe. In the past year, the Nigerian military has recaptured Kumshe and other villages in the northeast. But Boko Haram still inhabits rural areas. After 7 years of fighting, about 2 million Nigerians remain displaced from their homes. In Borno State, 500,000 live in camps without sufficient food, water, and medical attention. One refugee from Kumshe confirmed the location of the tribunal as his village. In an interview with VOA, he told of many other Boko Haram executions in the village, people accused of being drug users, vigilantes, and traitors. Shown still images of the village square from the Boko Haram video, he broke down. the scars from Boko Haram will not go away anytime soon. Next, inside a Boko Haram attack.
Leading United Nations and humanitarian organizations are calling for an end to FGM, or female genital mutilation, a traditional practice that causes physical harm and extreme emotional trauma to tens of millions of girls and women around the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Nearly 200 million girls and women are living with the harmful, traumatic consequences of female genital mutilation. And the United Nations reports an additional 3 million girls, most under the age of 15, continue to be mutilated every year. UN agencies report half of all women and girls have been cut in three countries, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Indonesia. They add the highest prevalence of FGM among girls ages 14 and under is found in Gambia, Mauritania, and Indonesia. Adebisi Adebayo is program advisor to the UN Inter-African Committee on Traditional Practices. She tells VOA that FGM, which has no formal basis in religion, persists because of social and cultural pressure.
In some communities, it's a requirement for girls to pass into womanhood. It is a requirement for them to be eligible for marriage. In some communities, like in Kenya, and I think also in Edo, which is in southwestern part of Nigeria, a girl that's not caught is not marriageable. And that is when you find an adult lady submitting, willingly submitting herself to be caught.
Female genital mutilation involves the partial or total removal of the external female genitalia for non-medical reasons. It is usually carried out by women circumcisers. In many places, however, FGM is carried out by health professionals, a practice the World Health Organization calls unethical. The United Nations says some progress is being made toward abolishing FGM. It reports that nearly 3,000 communities, where the UN Population Fund and UN Children's Fund work, have declared they are abandoning this practice. It says more progress must be made to reach the UN's sustainable development goal of ending female genital mutilation by 2030. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Small-scale farmers in Malawi continue to feel the effects of 2 years of bad harvests after the El Niño weather pattern brought drought and flooding. Many rely on food handouts from aid agencies, but some farmers have fared better thanks to cultivation methods they learned from a UN-funded hunger resilience initiative. Lamek Masina reports from Lilongwe.
Dennis Manda proudly walks us through his groundnut field in Nchinji district, stopping to remove a few weeds along the way.
For 1 year, we have 20 kgs of mbeu.
He says in the past he planted 20 kilograms of groundnut seeds on 1 acre, but now is able to plant 40 kilograms on 1 acre by planting in two rows. He says this means the harvest is as if he had grown a 2 acre garden, increasing profits. Double row planting is just one of the methods he learned 4 years ago when he joined an initiative run by the Rural Livelihood and Economic Enhancement Program, called RIP. The project encourages farmers to branch out into a wider variety of legume crops, like soya beans and groundnuts, as well as drought-resistant plants, like cassava and sweet potatoes. RIP National Director Dixon Ngwende says there have been particular success teaching farmers to produce their own certified seeds.
For the seed that we do within the community, we have a germination rate in excess of 90%. And for seed of groundnuts and soya, that is normally distributed by the commercial organizations, have as low as a 40% germination rate.
He says locally produced seeds do not endure multiple rounds of processing that can damage them. The project also urges farmers to apply beneficial bacteria to the seeds and fertilizers to the legumes to help the soil. About 40,000 farmers in 11 districts across Malawi have gotten the training, but the eight-year project is nearing the completion at the end of 2017. Visiting Malawi this month, International Fund for Agriculture Development President Kanayo Nwanze sought to allay fears progress will be reversed.
The whole purpose of a program or a project is to get farmers off the ground. Now the farmers have to take ownership of their business, access to certified seeds. So that is that's the opportunity for somebody to make a business from producing certified seeds.
The goal is resilience. As the expression goes, give someone a fish and he will eat for one day. Teach him to fish and he will feed a generation. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 7th. On this day, 1926, the first Negro History Week was observed. It was created by Dr. Carter G. Woodson and later changed to Black History Month in 1926. On this day in 1883, pianist U.B. Blake was born in Baltimore, Maryland. In 1921, he wrote the musical Shuffle Along, which became the most successful black show on Broadway. On this day in 1871, Alcorn College was founded in the state of Mississippi. It is the oldest historically black land-grant institution in the United States and the second oldest state-supported institution in the state of Mississippi. The school became Alcorn and Agricultural Mechanical College in 1878, initially serving only black males until women were enrolled in 1895. In 1974, the school became Alcorn State University after Governor William L. Waller signed a bill granting university status to Alcorn and other state-supported colleges. Did you know that Madam C.J. Walker was the first female African-American millionaire? Walker became a highly successful businesswoman by selling her own brand of cosmetics. She used much of her money to help the needy. On this day in 1984, Michael Jackson was entered into the Guinness Book of World Records for selling 25 million copies of his album, Thriller. And in African history, on this day in 1910, Britain, Germany, and Belgium agreed on the borders of Congo, Uganda, and German East Africa, which included what is today Burundi, Rwanda, and the mainland part of Tanzania. Also, on this day in African history, in 1961, Joseph Kasavubu was appointed president of a UN-supported confederation of independent Congolese states. Congratulations to Unchagwa Chacha Hamis of Terami Mara in Tanzania, Adikale Suma of Conakry, Guinea, and Ayuba Bulus Abimiku of Jiminta Yola in Adamawa State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 6th question. Who became the unofficial black heavyweight champion in 1903? The answer, John Jack Johnson. Now, here is our question for today, February 7th. Which African-American tennis player was the first to win at Wimbledon? Once again, which African-American tennis player was the first to win at Wimbledon? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Tuesday, February 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stradak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a very nice day.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the northern Nigeria-based terrorist group Boko Haram. The militant group has targeted both Muslims and Christians, killing more than 20,000 people since 2009. VOA has exclusively obtained secret video shot by Boko Haram that identifies its operatives committing acts of terror. We'll discuss the violent organization on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.